Hello, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today is someone who's actually incredibly well known in a very specific field, Dr. Mark Lewis. Mark, would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Yeah, first of all, Ross, thank you so much for having me and sharing your platform. So my name is Mark Lewis. I like to introduce myself as a patient-physician, because I always live on the front part of that hyphenate. I am a patient with a cancer syndrome. I've had treatments for that, and that fully informs the lens through which I see my oncology practice and career.
Where do you currently work?
So I work at Intermountain Health, just across the Rockies from you. It's a multi-state healthcare system based in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I am the director of gastrointestinal oncology here. So in addition to my own clinical work, I oversee how we take care of patients with cancers of the GI tract and accessory organs like the pancreas across our system.
Intermountain Healthcare, is that a kind of closed system? Is it like a kind of Kaiser system?
That's exactly the analogy that I've heard most often. So we sort of occupy actually the geography to the west of the Rockies and basically all the way to the Pacific Northwest. You are almost certainly familiar with the term oncology deserts, these large areas of land where oncologists may literally be quite sparsely distributed. And you and I also, as we might discuss, come from the UK. And I don't know about you, but when I moved here from Scotland, the biggest culture shock, if you will, was, yes, of course, differences in how Brits and Americans view the world, but really one of scale. So when I grew up, you know, it was a big, big deal to undertake a 40-mile journey from where I lived to see my grandmother. And then I moved to the United States, and there are these vast expanses now that we have to think about. And so, for instance, with Intermountain, technically speaking, we're responsible for something like a quarter of the U.S. landmass. Now, in terms of population density, those get into some very sparse areas indeed, states like Wyoming and Montana. And one of the big challenges of the last several years in particular is how we bring care to patients rather than magnetizing, you know, metropolitan areas and expecting people to travel when they're already sick. So that's been an interesting sort of logistical issue to overcome. Weirdly enough, the technology you and I are using right now, which of course really flourished during COVID, has actually helped us to do that.
Let's dig into that Scottish thing. So whereabouts in Scotland did you actually grow up, and for how long?
Yeah, so I had the request to use my accent on the podcast, so thanks for letting me.
Oh, actually, I can do that too.
Yeah. So I grew up in Edinburgh, and this is actually kind of key to my narrative, if you will. So my father was a professor of theology. He was a lecturer at the University of Edinburgh, the New College School of Divinity, and he was offered a five-year position in Texas. It was actually almost like a scholarly exchange program. We were supposed to come over for 5 years, and then a faculty member in Texas was supposed to go to Scotland. But what happened, Ross, actually extremely pertinent to your work, is when we immigrated, my father had a chest x-ray, which, as you know, is basically a public health measure. The U.S. government wanted to make sure that my dad didn't have tuberculosis.
I had one when I came, and it was like, oh my goodness, I feel like this is 1940.
Right, exactly. I've had to explain to people, especially in the last few years, this long predates COVID, right? This was a public health measure trying to sort of mitigate, you know, respiratory illness that's communicable. So we got this really sort of dispassionate phone call from the embassy. So someone that had looked at my dad's chest x-ray called him up and said, Mr. Lewis, got good news and bad news. The good news is you do not have tuberculosis and you can certainly move to the United States. The bad news is there is something occupying almost the entirety of your right lung. And when you get to America, you need to seek medical attention. This was part of our, you know, literal and figurative landing in this country, was trying to establish healthcare for my dad, who was completely blindsided. He was 42 at the time. For what it's worth, and you know this has to be taken with a grain of salt, he was a lifelong non-smoker. He was a theologian who didn't have a whole lot of occupational exposure. Completely ambushed by this news. And so we got to the States. We had to find a cardiothoracic surgery who was capable of removing this mass, and that turned out to be cancer. Very circuitously, that's how I got into oncology. So my dad was 42 when he was diagnosed. He was 49 when he died. And at that point, I was 14 years old and a freshman in high school. And I sort of realized in a very sort of immature and adolescent way, if you will, that cancer is my enemy. Like I wanted to take all kind of my adolescent angst and channel it into something productive. So sort of threw myself headlong into my studies and biology in particular. My dad's oncologist was so kind to me, took me under his wing and said, hey, listen, son, if you want to come work on my clinic, you're welcome. And so I worked in his cancer center every summer. I started as a medical assistant. I worked my way up to radiology technician. And then I became, after that, after college, a medical student. And so basically in medical school, as you know, we do a smorgasbord, we sample every specialty, but I always knew oncology was what I wanted to do. It was my passion. And it's been amazing to witness, as you're well aware, the improvements in care. My dad, I actually often cite him even now to my patients as sort of the stereotype of all the side effects that you envision and fear from chemo. So lost his hair, but less superficially than that, he was horribly nauseous, horribly sick. And, the chemo didn't work in the sense it really did not forestall the progression of his disease. And so that's been very sobering for us to remember. But I use it then to pivot very quickly to my patients and say, listen, almost all of those things have gotten better in the last 3 decades. And so in my sort of thought experiment where I have a time machine, I would love to go back and, take care of my dad using all the really wonderful drugs that have come along since he was first diagnosed.
Yeah, I remember I spoke to one of the guys who helped to develop one of the first antiemetics. And I said, when did you know it was working? He said, when the sound of vomiting stopped from the rooms.
Gosh, isn't that just, that's almost gives you chills to hear that. Yeah, I think the nausea was probably the worst part for my father. And as a child, I remember, one of your only times together as a family is around the dinner table. And for us, it was sort of a horribly tense affair. I remember kind of sitting there, it's just my mother, my dad and me, sort of eyeing my dad nervously to see if he could even get through a meal.
Yeah.
And that always stuck with me. So I think it's amazing, Ross, as you're saying, to kind of look back on the relatively short history of oncology and realize just how much antiemetics have improved and how they allow us now to get patients through highly emetogenic regimens. So that's one aspect. And the other thing that we'll get to here shortly is, my dad always wondered, why? I think this is the ultimate question before our patients that you and I might actually struggle to answer. Of course, there's the abstract, philosophical prompt, why do bad things happen to good people? But as you and I know, when a person's sitting in front of you and they say, doctor, why did this happen to me? Oftentimes, we have to admit that we don't know. My father's cancer, as it turns out, was hereditary. And looking again in hindsight, his dad had died of a very mysterious cancer that also arose in his chest when he was in his 60s, and no one could ever explain it. And as we'll, sure we'll explore, finally, science and my own curiosity kind of dovetailed. And in the early 2000s, I was able to figure out what was going on in my family, which is actually a germline syndrome. So I've inherited from my father, my literal forefathers, this mutation that causes some cancers. And I've actually inadvertently passed it on to my son. And I have no problem talking about that. My son himself is about to be 13 years old, and he's very interested in sort of spreading the word, if you will.
Yeah.
About familial cancer risk.
Let's go back in the time machine just a little bit. So you were about 8 when your dad was diagnosed.
That's right.
And 14 when he died.
Yeah.
Do we have a label? And we have to be careful with labels, especially in retrospect. But what exactly did he die from?
Yeah, great question. So it was a thymic neuroendocrine carcinoma. And I'm actually really glad, Ross, that you're focusing on labels. I think one of the things I've realized in my career is just how powerful, maybe even indelible, the words that we say to patients. My father was a really intelligent man. He was a true scholar in his field. But, medical jargon was certainly not his lingua franca. And the way his doctors, his excellent doctors, described his cancer to him was as a lung cancer.
Wow.
And again, you and I know that's not exact at all. But it led my dad down a completely different path of how he conceived of his cancer. I'll tell you, he really thought that his cancer arose through exposure to secondhand smoke. That's what he thought. He went to his grave thinking that. And again, I bring that up now. I think it's still a relevant point. I see so many of our patients go through really needless sort of self-recrimination. If only I hadn't done that, I wouldn't now have cancer. And my father had no clue. He really had no idea at all that his cancer arose from a hereditary risk. So what happened in the end, Ross, was the pneumonectomy, the lung cancer surgery that was mislabeled, did not cure him at all of his disease. He had a really significant amount of disease left behind the sternum, as you might imagine, for a thymic neoplasm.
Yeah.
So he had pretty crude radiation to that area in the late 80s. Talk about childhood memories. I remember my dad coming home from one of his radiation treatments and he just took his shirt off. And, you know, nowadays, of course, it's become much more precise. People get tattoos. He literally had a big red X drawn on his chest with an indelible marker, right? Which tells you something about the field as well. And so he suffered horrible side effects from the radiation. And then finally, what happened, of course, was, and I sound awfully fatalistic, but the cancer metastasized particularly painfully to his bones. And so he was treated with a regimen that you and I actually might still use today for certain high-grade neuroendocrine cancers. He got cisplatin etoposide. And the one thing I have to tell you about Providence, which is fascinating to me, you and I now live in an era where the FDA is approving new cancer drugs, it seems like, almost monthly.
Yeah.
So the part that really got me interested in oncology, and this is going to sound like a strange entree, but in 1991, my father was hospitalized with neutropenic sepsis after his cisplatin etoposide. His neutrophil count was literally zero. And we were called into the ICU, my mother and I, and said, you know, this man is not going to survive this. This infection is too overwhelming. His immune system is literally vanished. And that week, the FDA approved Neupogen, approved G-CSF.
Wow.
And so I have this memory in my head of the oncologist coming in. And the way I described it, even to my own kids, is it was like a magic trick. He came in, he had this shot, and he said, you know, Mr. Lewis, I'm going to give you this shot under the skin, and believe it or not, you know, somehow, some way, this chemical is going to go to your bone marrow and boost your immune defenses. I take it for granted now that you and I can do that. But, you know, this was the early 90s, and this was such like a leap forward in our supportive care. That saved my dad's life, at least for another 3 years. And those 3 years were incredibly valuable to him. He finished a manuscript he'd been writing his entire career, and incredibly valuable to my mother and I that we got 3 more years with him. So I tell patients now, I say, you know, we shouldn't really take for granted, again, these advances. It's incredible to have new drugs, and not always drugs that are directly, you know, anti-neoplastic, right? So
What
really, I think, again, as you said earlier, the antiemetics have gotten better. You know, growth factor and other supportive agents have improved. And I think that's allowing us, part and parcel, to take better care of our patients as a whole.
So it's funny, for lung cancer, where there have been a lot of developments, sometimes I tell the patients that you just have to stay alive and well, because some of the research will actually move around you. You know, it's almost like surfing a wave. If you can just stay on the crest of the wave and not crash off, you know, you'll just keep going.
I love that analogy. I might even steal that and use that in my own conversations with patients. I tell my patients all the time, I know you would like your cancer to get smaller, to regress, and of course, to go away altogether. But the way I often spin it, actually, Ross, is I say, sort of very similar to you, I say, listen, stability to me is an acceptable endpoint much of the time for exactly the reason you stated. Because if we can keep a patient's cancer burden stable, and I'm a GI oncologist, so many of my patients are trying to stabilize their liver burden, in particular of metastases, I say, listen, I think I can keep you alive long enough that either you can gain some sort of endogenous resilience, like the liver can regenerate, or, like you just said, some new drug might come along. I don't think we're dangling false hope in front of patients when we say that. I think there's a very reasonable optimism there.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like progress happens in this kind of concertina fashion. Sometimes you get like boom, 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 and amazing results all come out. And then there's a kind of like, okay, we're going to wait for the next breakthrough. And, you know, sometimes that can be years, but the trajectory is always upwards and always forward.
Exactly right. And I'll tell you, you know, our patients are getting so savvy now. So, for instance, you and I are recording this in mid-January, and next week I'm actually traveling to the biggest GI oncology conference of the year. And my patients are so savvy, so sophisticated, that they are already asking me, you know, Dr. Lewis, do you think trial X or trial Y is going to mature, and they'll hear about it at this conference? That's the level at which they're invested in this research. And of course they are. They're the ultimate stakeholders in their outcome. I think where I sometimes have to be a little careful, Ross, is, you know, tempering their expectations a little bit. You and I, I'm sure, have seen together many things that were very promising in early phases. say, a phase one or certainly a phase two trial that then doesn't mature the way we hope in a phase three study. But all of that is not to take away, I think, this, like you say, this very legitimate belief that the arc of oncology is bending towards progress. It's just always the question is it progressing fast enough to help the person that's sitting in front of you in that exam room?
Again, it's funny. When I started, lung cancer was definitely the kind of like, why would you want to go into lung cancer? It was as, you know, good news as pancreatic cancer. Now we've got, for some people with lung cancer, we're having discussions about whether they can have children.
Yes.
And it's like, whoa. So we're talking about longevity with advanced stage cancer in decades.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. When you look at some of the tails of these curves, right, especially I'm thinking, of course, of like immunotherapy, you look at the long tail of some of these survival curves and you really have to wonder, you know, is that actually not just a durable remission, but can we very carefully use the word cure? And it's funny, you get the same, I don't know if pessimism is the right word, but the same sort of questions about you going into lung cancer that I get going into GI oncology. People say, why on earth would you choose to go and do battle, if you permit that metaphor, with pancreas cancer? And I say, listen, I know it is not evident at sort of a micro level, but when you step back, we really are making not steady, but some progress against pancreas cancer. And again, I love your analogy of the concertina. I think it's exactly like that.
Your dad was a minister. When he was in Texas, was he actually preaching? I don't even know if that's the right word.
No, you're doing great. Yeah, no. So he taught at a seminary. So really what he was doing was teaching other people how to minister to their congregations. And he was very scholarly. Like, one of the things that really stuck with me in terms of work ethic is this is a man that would, you know, go through the brutal rigors of both radiation and chemo that we've described. And he would come home, and my childhood bedroom was through a very thin wall from his study. And just to kind of, again, place this in time, this was before even he had a computer, he had a typewriter. And so I could hear him clacking away late into the night on his work. And the reason I bring this up at this point in the conversation, Ross, is I think when you and I know that our patients have, at least by conventional standards, incurable disease, it's actually our responsibility to tell them that, because I think that knowing your time is finite, and of course that's true for all of us, is actually a really powerful impetus for them to do the things that really matter to them. We talk a lot, of course, in the palliative settings about legacy building, like deliberately making memories with your family. But for my dad, in his professional work, his scholarly work, he was like, you know, I've got to finish this book before cancer takes my life. And he did that. As it turns out, it wasn't published until 7 years posthumously, so he didn't live to see it actually in print. But that really stuck with me, and I kind of reached a fork in the road where I had to decide as a relatively young man, do I want to follow my dad into ministry and theology, or am I compelled now to follow this other path into medicine? Because I'm actually breaking a chain of several ministers and professors even before him. My grandfather, I mentioned earlier, died of the same disease, although we didn't know it. He was a minister in Belfast in the 1960s and 70s and actually really important to the peace process there. So I had a lot of reasons to believe this was a very noble profession. And there was a tradition of sort of pastoral care in my family. But that's why, again, my dad's illness is what pulled me completely a different way and sent me sort of headlong, if you will, into oncology. I didn't know what I was signing up for. I certainly didn't know I was going to be a patient myself, but I am, in hindsight, really glad that I chose to pursue this career.
Let's go into the detective work. Your CV is filled with a recurring lecture, which is called something like The Fortune and Folly of Self-Diagnosis.
Yes, exactly.
Did you start to dig into what turned into a familial cancer syndrome just as a curiosity about your father, or when did it become, hey, I'm looking at myself?
Yeah, thanks for picking up on that. And that's a lecture I've given many times because that title for me captures the ups and downs of the process. You're absolutely right to phrase the question that way as well. I honestly took at face value that my dad's cancer was entirely sporadic. I had no reason to believe it was familial. I couldn't see a pattern. But, you know, two points make a line, right? And one of the things that had really plagued my dad his entire life, his entire adulthood, was kidney stones. And again, it seemed like such a tiny detail. When you and I take a family history now, Ross, we probably focus, I imagine, much more on who had cancer and when than what may even seem like an incidental detail, like, oh, by the way, my father was, you know, dealing with kidney stones from his teens onward.
I think that isn't a question that I would ask. I mean, if they volunteered it, great. I wonder if that's part of your normal questions you ask now.
Well, it is now, but that's that. I'm betraying my bias. So, and no one had ever explained to my father satisfactorily why he was getting the kidney stones over and over again. They were leading up to, I promise, my own sort of eureka moment. When I got to medical school, I knew that my father must have suffered from some form of really persistent hypercalcemia. I believed that. I didn't have proof of that. All of his medical records were destroyed. I've got nothing to go on there. But I'm just inferring that. And then I'm literally day one, I'm starting my oncology fellowship. I did my fellowship at the Mayo Clinic, which is important because we'll get to the diagnostics here in a second. And I woke up, I just felt terrible, Ross. I had this horrible abdominal pain. And in my mind, you know how this goes, the differential that pops up, you know, ranges from the mundane to the esoteric, right? I did not wake up that day thinking, oh, by the way, today's the day you figure out that you've inherited a cancer-causing mutation from your father. So I woke up, had horrible abdominal pain. I didn't think it was nerves, and it was actually kind of localizing to the right lower quadrant. So I thought, well, maybe this is appendicitis.
Yeah.
So I went in and got, you know, evaluated urgently. And the one data point that stuck out like a sore thumb was my calcium level was quite high. And I remember thinking in that moment, you know, I know enough of this at this stage to be dangerous. I did medical school. I had done residency. I was starting as a fellow. And I knew just enough to be aware that there's really only two conditions that can cause high calcium, hypercalcemia, to pass from one generation to the next. One entirely benign, which is familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, and the other being some form of familial hyperparathyroidism.
Yep.
And indeed, it was the latter. And that, for me, was the moment everything clicked. I was like, oh my goodness, this is what was happening to my dad. This is what is happening to me. So again, I'm at Mayo. They assign me to an internist. And just imagine for a second what this poor internist has to deal with. I'm walking in as a first day, first week fellow, now convinced that I have a hereditary tumor syndrome. And the reason I titled my lecture The Fortune and Folly of Self-Diagnosis is his number one presumption was that I was a hypochondriac.
Of course.
Right. And who can blame the guy, right? And it's interesting. I take care of about a quarter of my patients I've described as having rare tumors. And I see them have to navigate sort of the same channels of sort of doubt and needing to prove themselves that I had to go through to get to sort of my correct label. And that was even with me, Ross, playing, if you will, the card of professional courtesy. I said to my internist, I said, listen, I know this sounds crazy, but please, please, please believe me. And I sort of beseeched him to help me order, because I didn't think self-ordering was ethical, to yeah. order tests that would prove that I have multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, MEN1, and indeed I do. And so the really interesting part of all this to me, talk about dances. The mutation that runs in my family that causes MEN1 was only described in 2007. So let's say I had gotten curious, like you said earlier in my medical training, as to whether I had MEN1. If I had gone in and gotten tested any time before 2007, my dad died in 94, I would have been told I was negative.
I'm going to challenge you on that just a
little
bit.
Sure.
So MEN1 was described before there was a genetic test.
Yes, agreed. That's exactly right. But at the time, it was described as basically having, you know, sort of two of three areas of the body being clinically affected, right?
Yep.
And you're entirely correct. So MEN1 was actually first sussed out by a really astute internist in New York in the 1950s and 60s who was taking care of a large Italian family. And an alarming number of them, actually exactly half, both men and women, were dying of stomach ulcers that either bled or ruptured or both. And so he actually figured out, Dr. Wormer, that this was MEN1, and that was for years called Wormer syndrome. So you're entirely correct, Ross. Maybe if I had been symptomatic from hypercalcemia, and if I'd been found to have a problem in either my pituitary gland or my pancreas, you're right. There was a clinical phenotype there that would have fit. But if I'd gone in with purely a genetic angle,
yeah,
I think you and I know we're in the infancy or maybe the adolescence of that. I suspect, especially with the skepticism that my internist held, that I'd have been told, oh, you don't have to worry as much. Your genetics turned out just fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, although you were lucky with the Mayo, which does love its esoteric syndromes.
Exactly right. I've said that many times. I said if I wasn't in the Mayo Clinic, I think this would have taken even longer to prove. But I say all this partly as a gesture of empathy to patients with rare diseases. You and I are well aware of the whole versus zebra dichotomy. I still tell my students in training is, listen, don't let my own experience derail you. You know, common things are common. And it's totally fine to entertain esoteric diagnoses if your presumptions keep getting overturned. Like if you're going down the list of what you think is probable and things are being eliminated, you sort of end up with the quote from Conan Doyle that whatever's left at the end, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. And so I think, you know, the diagnostic heuristic, if you will, it's still very appropriate to start with the more prevalent diseases without entirely dismissing. First of all, patient self-report, I think, is crucial. And also, again, being open-minded enough, having intellectual humility to accept that there are some rare explanations for seemingly common presentations, like, again, a high calcium level.
So one of the things that I was taught in medical school, so I went to Oxford, and, you know, it was all full of itself about how esoteric it was. But, you know, one of the things is, you know, we ask the question, is like, well, why do they teach us these incredibly rare things that are all stuck in our memories now?
Yes.
And the answer was, if you just relied on clinical experience, you would never see them. So you have to drill them in, because otherwise you would miss them.
That's exactly right. And it's funny to say that, because I had actually been stuck myself on the mnemonic that I was taught, I suspect you were taught too, for multiple endocrine neoplasia, which is the three Ps.
Yeah.
So pituitary, parathyroid, and pancreas all aligned in the midline, right? Thymic neuroendocrine carcinoma is not in that mnemonic. In medical school, I can remember now, I actually went back to my syllabus and looked it up. I remember now, that's all they taught us. So you're absolutely right that at some point in your medical training, you have to be exposed to the zebras. But even then, you run the risk of being a bit too reductive in these kind of memory devices that you use. So I, frankly, I'm almost a little bit embarrassed in hindsight. It took me so long to put this all together. On the other hand, you know, I had, I think, a single sentence, maybe a paragraph in one lecture in my 4 years of medical school that talked about this condition, right? And so you're actually living with it and having the embodied experience of being a patient, it's not immediately going to come to mind.
So did the aforementioned internist say, okay, Dr. Lewis, we're going to send off a genetic test? Or, you know, was there some arm wrestling? You know, when you see the result of that genetic test, which presumably you know is this definitive yes, no, was it a kind of like, oh, great, I've got the answer, or, oh, you know, poop, I've got the answer? You know?
Can I say it was a bit of both? I'd like to say I wasn't gloating that I was right, because that was sort of a Pyrrhic victory, right? Like, I was correct, but now I had to face the consequences of being right. And, you know, I actually, as I sort of hope prefaced all this, I have the utmost respect for that internist. I mean, goodness sake, he was at Mayo. He was probably quite used to dealing with people who came in convinced that they had something rare and then had to sort of gently but firmly disabuse them of that notion. And I was, I think, sort of fitting his sort of framing when I walked into his office and said that. So he was very gracious. Again, he admitted when the test came back, of course, immediately let me know the result, admitted that I'd been correct. But then you're correct also, Ross, I had to deal with the implications. So I was in training still, and I went to my fellowship director and said, I think almost immediately, listen, this is what I just found out. And I sort of felt like they had taken a bad gamble on me as a fellow. I was supposed to be there for 3 years. I didn't know at that point if I was going to be able to fulfill my years of training. And actually, I was. I was able to get the hypercalcemia under control by doing a relatively simple parathyroid surgery. And then I didn't have to deal with my pancreas, where tumors eventually emerged, until much, much later. It was very informative for me because, as you might imagine, now my entire fellowship, my entire training in cancer medicine was seen through this, unavoidably seen through this lens. And so it really affected my training, and it's absolutely affected my practice now more than a decade later.
So I got a couple of questions there. So how old were you when you got the diagnosis then?
30.
And you were married, had kids at that point?
I did. I already had one child, and my wife and I had not yet had our second. And I have no problem talking about this because, as you and I know, when you have an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance, and MEN1 is a classic example of that, it means there's a 50-50 chance that each one of your children will be affected. So it's a coin flip. And I've often said in lectures too, it's one thing to look at a pedigree and see the half-half distribution. It's completely another to be faced with the prospect of having a child and, again, flipping that coin. And this was also, Ross, sort of in the nascent years of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So one of the things my wife and I were offered, again, at the Mayo, was, would you like us to do essentially an enhanced form of in vitro fertilization, where it's IVF plus selection of embryos that don't have the MEN1 mutation? So my wife and I talked about this. Number one, we were still in our training and we could not afford said technology. And number two, and I don't really want to get into the moral thorn bush of all this, but I thought, well, if my parents had applied that same technology to me, I technically wouldn't be here. So I think the thing about MEN1 that's interesting and that distinguishes it from far more lethal genetic syndromes is almost all of us, thankfully, survive to childbearing age, if you will, which actually allows the mutation to perpetuate. So my son now, Alan, who's named after my late father, eventually is going to have to wrestle, I suspect, with the same questions. But I hope that by the time he's thinking about having children, if he ever does, that maybe these issues of ethics and technology will be more resolved for him. But yes, so I think what you're getting at is we kind of rolled the dice, and my son has MEN1, and my daughter, who was already born, does not. So my kids are a perfect example of the 50-50 split of autosomal dominant inheritance.
When did you test Alan?
So I'm a bit of a data-obsessed doctor. So I knew it wasn't immediately going to affect how we took care of him per se, but I wanted to know fairly early on. So we tested him when he was still an infant and got the result back. And I'll be honest, Ross, one of the hardest days of my life, because I remember thinking, you know, what have I done? Like, I technically, I suppose, could have prevented this. We didn't need to have another child. We could have been perfectly satisfied, I suspect, one. But, you know, I'm an only child. My wife is an only child. It was always very sort of important to us that we think about having more than one child, because to us, like, having a sibling would have made our childhoods easier. I don't know if that's true. But regardless, you know, now I look at my boy. He's so vigorous and absolutely his own person and is living his own life. I don't think he'll go into medicine. You know, the world's his oyster as far as I'm concerned. But I also see him, and I really believe this, I see him being forewarned in a way that I wasn't, and in a way that certainly his more distant forefathers weren't. And so I think forewarned is forearmed. Like, I've told him for years now that he inherited this from me. We actually have like a secret handshake we do. We talk about being in the club of the Lewis men. I've tried to make it, this is going to sound weird because it's definitely a pathogenic mutation. I've tried to make it a relatively benign yet unavoidable part of his identity. I'll tell you also, both as a doctor and as a father, one of the hardest parts for me going through the Whipple operation several years ago is he was definitely old enough then to see what this disease could look like in some of its more fearsome incarnations. And I've told him many times since, listen, you know, that was a brutal time in our lives, a very, very difficult surgery to get through. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to need that surgery or that you'll ever need anything done to your pancreas at all. So I think what's interesting is genotype-phenotype correlation is very, very weak in MEN1. Just because something happened to my dad or my grandfather doesn't mean it's going to happen to me. And by the same token, the things that have happened to me won't necessarily happen to my boy. It's an interesting place to be sitting because it also helps me counsel patients on certainty versus uncertainty. And one of the things I think we all do as oncologists is help patients grapple with the unknown. And as a doctor, I say this very cautiously, I think my experience as a patient has made me, I don't know if better physician is the right word, it's certainly made me more understanding of some of the challenges that our patients face when they have to take all these statistics, which seem very abstract, and apply them to their own experience. And that's a very difficult gulf to cross.
You're going through oncology training, you get an MEN1 diagnosis. Do you gravitate towards MEN1 as something that you specialize in, or do you say, look, I just want to stay well away from that and, you know, patient physician? I mean, that hyphen in the patient physician, how strong did you decide to make it during your training?
As I mentioned earlier, my dad is a writer, and I'm not nearly the author that he is, the wordsmith that he is or was. But it was really important for me to sort of get all these weird feelings I was having into words. So I published an essay in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, essentially the year after my MEN1 diagnosis. my attendings, my senior guides, if you will, in training came to me and said, Mark, you're playing with fire here, because once you do this, once you disclose your condition, you can never get your confidentiality back. Are you sure this is something that you want to do? And I actually thought, and still think, it's a privilege. It really is a privilege for me to be able to disclose my condition. And I'm still glad that I did it. But my point is, to your question, yes, I just the way I sort of charged into oncology after seeing what my dad was dealing with when I was still a teenager, I leaned into the world of rare tumors. Once again, it was providential. I was at Mayo. Rare tumors were thick on the ground.
Yeah.
And so I gravitated towards faculty that were taking care of endocrine and esoteric neoplasms. And so that became a part of my practice once I got out of fellowship.
So you became an expert in your own disease.
That's very kind of you to say. I have embodied expertise. And, you know, it's funny how niche these things get. So there is actually a worldwide MEN1 sort of brain trust, if you will, funnily enough, centered in Oxford, your alma mater. And that group, which is just an absolute murderer's row of really, really smart people from endocrinology and endocrine surgery and medical oncology, have embraced me, not because I've gone through sort of the traditional routes of scholarly advancement, but embraced me as a patient.
Yeah.
And they often bring me to the table and say, Mark, how would XYZ recommendation, how would that sort of sit with you as a patient? So I feel so included and really accepted by that group. And yeah, that feeds back into everything else I do professionally.
I was trying to figure this out in preparation for this talk about how rare MEN1 is. So,
yeah.
You know, when you're with your son, it's like, hey, we're part of a really big club, or is a very exclusive club. So if you think about in the USA, how many MEN1 patients are there?
Yeah, great question. So the incidence that we would estimate in the US, Ross, is about 1 in 30,000. So when you just think about the US population, that means that we're no more than the very low sort of 10,000 range, I would suspect. So still qualifying for rare tumor designation by the definition from the NIH and the NCI. But I think that the larger picture, though, is if you sum up, and I'm sure you've heard this, if you sum up all of the rare diagnoses, then they really do become a very prevalent entity. So yes, while I fly the flag for MEN1, what I really hope I'm doing is raising awareness for, like I said, like you said, those rare diseases, those diagnoses that are tucked away in sort of the dusty crevices of our hippocampus that you just every now and then you need to bring to the surface because the patient in front of you just isn't fitting whatever, you know, diagnostic box you were trying to put them into. So that's frankly the reason, the biggest reason I've been so, some would say, some critics would say self-aggrandizing and self-promoting, I would like to say vocal, is that I know for a fact there are so many patients out there who, frankly, have been mislabeled. The best example I can give you, and I know our time is coming to a close. So carcinoid syndrome, right? You know, so a tumor that typically arises in the mid-gut and then spreads elsewhere in the body looks like so many other diseases. And again, because of the practice I've cultivated, I have a disproportionate number of carcinoid syndrome patients that come to me. On average, it takes them 7 years from when they first became symptomatic until they get the right diagnosis. And the reason that matters is along the way, number one, they're not being treated properly. Number two, they're actually accumulating a series of incorrect labels. So for instance, in the stigmata of carcinoid syndrome, the flushing of that disease, which is caused by serotonin excess, especially in women, is often explained away as hot flashes.
Yeah.
And the wheezing is explained as adult onset asthma, and the diarrhea is explained as irritable bowel syndrome. And so now you've got this constellation of things that, in fact, the patient doesn't have at all, but it's almost like a snowball effect, and they just keep building and building the wrong labels. And by the way, along the way, they're also starting to mistrust, perhaps understandably, the healthcare system that keeps giving them the wrong labels and, by extension, the wrong treatment. So I'm very savvy, perhaps some would say overly sensitive to how that process plays out. And again, at some level, I have to give due credit to the primary care physicians out there. I don't know how you feel. I think even within oncology, we have a breadth and a depth issue where general oncologists who have to see every tumor under the sun have an incredibly difficult job.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about primary care doctors who are trying to figure out, is the person in front of me dealing with some very, very common disease? Or are they, like you said yourself, the type of person that you might only encounter once a year or once in your career? And constantly having that tiny little voice, not necessarily of doubt, but of intellectual inquiry in the back of your head, it's very, very difficult to calibrate that without working everybody up to the nines. You know what I mean? So I think that's a tension that I see at the primary care level, and I'm starting to see it more and more even within oncology at large.
So I have a friend who's a primary care physician. I've had this discussion with him. And the other thing he pointed out is like, well, you can sit down and spend an hour with the patient. I have to do it in a series of 10-minute appointments spread over a year or something. I mean, they get this jigsaw, the intellectual jigsaw over time.
Right. That's very well said. The best analogy I've ever heard is there was a book written, gosh, maybe 15 years ago now, called How Doctors Think. You might have read it. You might remember Dr. Groopman in there. His analogy of primary care is the primary care physician is standing beside a train track and he's watching a carriage flash by at high speed. And he's looking at the faces in the windows of the train car, and he has to pick out the one person in that brief glimpse who is truly, truly sick with something rare, while still attending to all the people that have, you know, more common diagnoses. I found that a very affecting piece of imagery that's definitely stuck with me. And again, I hope it doesn't come across in our conversation that I in any way hold resentment towards that internist at Mayo, because you said your reaction was actually very telling. Of course I came across like a hypochondriac until all the facts came to light. And so I think we just have to approach our patients with, I guess, some degree maybe of healthy skepticism while still taking them seriously. I think when a patient comes back to you again and again and again, like your friend who has these 10-minute increments, and they're not getting better, and perhaps they might getting worse, I think at some point you have to challenge whatever diagnosis you've anchored on and start thinking outside the box. But you're right, maybe the biggest currency that we all share that's so precious is time. Who has, honestly, the time to do a full differential on every patient in front of them? I know most primary care doctors do not.
It's funny, I remember knowing that there's a direct correlation between the number of visits in the preceding months and a diagnosis of cancer.
Yes.
Because it's like you say, it's the person coming back, being blown off each time. But that cumulative experience is actually a big alarm bell going off.
That's precisely right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's sort of raising the doctors, surely the patients, but the doctors' index of suspicion that something more is going on. We just haven't put our finger on it yet.
There's a couple of things I want to touch on. You dropped in the word Whipple. We better explain what a Whipple procedure is and how did you get to that?
So as you rightly said, long before actually we knew even where the MEN1 gene is located, which is on the one arm of chromosome number 11. So long before we test for that, it was a clinical diagnosis. So you would tell somebody they had, or at least suspected they had MEN1 if they had hyperparathyroidism. So overactive parathyroid glands are really the hallmark feature of the syndrome. Basically, everybody with MEN1, almost without exception, will get overactive parathyroid glands, which leads to the high calcium we talked about earlier. But then it really is a bit of a crapshoot, I suppose, whether or not you get tumors in your pituitary gland or you get tumors in the pancreas. So I started getting a pretty serious abdominal pain, actually even before my MEN1 diagnosis, and it persisted after I had my parathyroid surgery. So I knew something was going on in my abdomen. So once we addressed the parathyroid glands, I had some really extensive testing. Again, I was very fortunate to be at Mayo with great doctors. And they took an ultrasound probe and slid it down my throat through my stomach next to my pancreas, so endoscopic ultrasound. And the first time they did that, the gastroenterologist, once I came out of the procedure, said, well, Mark, your pancreas is absolutely riddled with tumors. Not what you want to hear.
Riddled is never a good word in oncology.
Never a good word. Yeah, absolutely right, yeah. Talk about alarm bells, right?
Yeah.
But I think the key distinction here, Ross, and you know this, but it's important to elaborate for the audience, is not all tumors in the pancreas equal the colloquial definition of pancreatic cancer. So pancreatic adenocarcinoma is its own separate beast, which thankfully is not a part of MEN1. It is, however, still a very, very difficult disease to deal with, as you hinted earlier when you and I were talking about lung versus GI cancer, regardless. So all of these tumors arose in my pancreas, and they were very, very small, but they were so innumerable because I have a genetic condition. So basically every cell in my body, I was born with this defect, is prone to, of course, carrying at least one mutation in the MEN1 gene. And as I go through life, sporadically, I can sort of knock out the other good copy. Anyway, the point was, I didn't actually have to act upon, funnily enough, the discovery of these tumors. They were all so small that my doctor had advised me, you know what, Mark, the best thing to do here, and it sounds counterintuitive at first, is to watch them. Because the only cure, air quotes, is to have the entire pancreas completely removed. And remember, at the time, I'm in my early 30s, I'm trying to get my career off the ground, and I'm thinking, gosh, this is going to be really tricky to do, if not impossible, if I have zero pancreas. And talk about therapeutic advances, I actually think this decision might even look differently now than it would then, because back then we didn't have continuous glucose monitoring. There was really very few ways, if any, to sustain somebody that didn't have a pancreas at all. Certainly not in the way that I was looking to balance my life and work. So I opted for observation. So what we did then, Ross, was we used the same technique, the same ultrasound technique, every year to monitor my pancreatic tumors until at least some of them started growing in a fashion that looked threatening. So the Whipple procedure, you're right, it's an eponym. The technical term is pancreatic choduodenectomy. So you take out the pancreas and necessarily the adjacent curve of the small intestine. For what it's worth, the gallbladder goes with it, and you have to reconnect some of the bowel ducts afterwards. So it's a big, big operation that really should only be accomplished, in my mind, by a pancreatic surgeon who does at least 10 of these a year. So I had mine in 2017.
Was it an open Whipple or was it laparoscopic?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, it was open. And my surgeon explained to me why he preferred to open for sort of reasons of safety and technical closures and all these kind of things. So it was open, but it was a big, big deal. And again, this is where I come back to my practice. My patients who do have the traditional form of pancreas cancer, many of them would literally give their eye teeth to have a Whipple procedure because that would mean that we think that their cancer is potentially, not being the operative word, potentially curable with surgery. So if the cancer is, for those patients, confined to the head of the pancreas, and if it hasn't and doesn't spread anywhere else, then that surgery, which is a big, big deal, big undertaking, can potentially cure those patients. But honestly, Ross, what I find so eye-opening and sobering is 85% of my patients with traditional pancreas cancer are never going to go to the operating room because either their cancer was inextricably involved with blood vessels around the pancreas at the time of diagnosis and or they were dealing with metastases,
yeah,
either initially or eventually. I certainly realized then, I think I've actually realized it more since then, that I am actually really lucky to have been a candidate for this surgery. Again, many of my patients would wildly switch places with me, which is a funny thing to say. But that's where I think I gained the most empathy, is I haven't had chemotherapy yet. I've not yet needed radiation, but I have required a big, arguably life-changing operation. And that too has affected the way I look at oncology, certainly the way I look at how you and I might come up with multidisciplinary care plans for our patients. I imagine in your field, you have a lot of crosstalk, I would imagine, with thoracic surgeons and radiation oncologists, sort of figuring out if or when is the right time to go to surgery. And I think I'm now much better suited, having been through it myself, in counseling my patient on that kind of risk-benefit calculus.
I remember, and you know, remember I work above the diaphragm mostly, that the scar should be pretty impressive on your tummy. Was it like the Mercedes-Benz sign? Is that how they do it?
Yes, I know this is largely audio, so I'll just describe it. I won't put you or your listeners through anything more vivid than that, but it's just a straight line going from right underneath my sternum down to my belly button. So no Mercedes-Benz symbol for me, just a nice, boring, linear incision. But I will tell you this. I mean, I was really struck by the difference between reading about the Whipple and going through it. And the analogy that you may have heard me use at some point in one of these talks I've given is, to me, this is the difference between a pilot and a bird. So the pilot understands all the principles of flight. They know things like, you know, lift and thrust and drag. But the bird just knows what it feels like to fly without necessarily internalizing any of those things. So now I know what a Whipple feels like. And the reason I bring that up, Ross, is I'm not saying our peers are ever dismissive, but I see some of them bringing up the Whipple and actually sometimes bringing up chemotherapy in such close proximity to the Whipple that I realize they don't entirely understand what it's like to go through this operation. And if I can just widen our focus here for a second, this to me is actually an issue that affects all oncologists. You don't have to be me. You don't have to have been through Whipple. When we prescribe chemotherapy, very, very few of us have actually had chemo.
Yeah.
So the other analogy I've used is like we're teetotal bartenders. We're serving up all these like really potent cocktails. We've never had a sip, right? We don't actually know what it's like. And in my wife's training, she's a pediatrician. One of the things they did I thought was so brilliant, not chemotherapy, thank heavens, but they had the pediatricians taste the antibiotics that they were going to prescribe to kids. So they would understand why, say, clindamycin is completely unpalatable to a four-year-old. Now, you and I don't do that. We certainly shouldn't do that ethically. But my point is, we don't really understand the toxicity of chemotherapy on like an embodied level. And the biggest reason I bring this up sometimes, Ross, is the adjacency of chemo to major surgeries like the Whipple. So oftentimes there's a real rush once you've done a Whipple surgery for traditional pancreas cancer, and you know this, to give chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, sort of mopping up the microscopic residue.
Yeah.
And typically we're trying to do that within 2 months of the surgery. And I will tell you from personal experience, again, remember, I didn't need chemo at all. I remember vividly 2 months out from surgery thinking, there's no way, there's absolutely no way you could give me chemotherapy right now and I could consider it tolerable. I had a really tough postoperative recovery. My stomach basically, for want of a better word, stopped working for 5 weeks. So I had a tube down my nose for 5 weeks. I was being nourished through an IV line. And I was barely back on my feet by the 2 month mark. And for someone to have come along at that point and said, hey, by the way, Mark, now we're going to give you chemo, I would have found that completely untenable. And so, you know, the people that have to listen to me rant about this at our local tumor board will tell you, I bring this up a lot. I remind them just how difficult it is to overcome some of these surgeries, let alone get through the chemos that precious few of us have actually experienced ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, you've walked the walk and not just talked the talk. Given all you've been through, one of the things I've been struck through, and in fact, how I actually kind of tracked you down in the first place, is your very prominent presence in social media. So talk a little bit about how you got into that. You must have been an early adopter and what that means to you.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So this actually goes back to my Mayo days. So when I went through my parathyroid surgery at Mayo, my surgeon said to me, Mark, you're an ME1 patient. We don't actually see people like you every day, even here at the Mayo. Can I videotape your operation and show it to my trainees? And I was completely on board with this. I thought, what a wonderful idea. But then the thing was, you know, that recording is in now some dusty library at the Mayo Clinic, and it's viewed maybe by some surgical trainees. So my point being, Ross, when my Whipple surgery came around in 2017, I thought, you know what, I actually have, again, I have a very rare opportunity here to totally waive my confidentiality and to quite literally put it all out there. So I went to my surgeon and I said, listen, this is going to sound crazy, but would you be okay if we document my surgery on Twitter? And he was completely on board. To his enormous credit, he said to me, you might appreciate this. He said, listen, Mark, he said, when I'm doing a surgery, my entire world reduces down to the operative field. He's like, I don't care how many people you bring into the operating room. It's not going to distract me from doing the job at hand. And I thought, well, that's nice to hear. So we live tweeted my surgery.
Tweeting to me is there's somebody typing. So I'm assuming you're actually anesthetized. So
yes, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. That is actually a very important distinction. So the final piece of the puzzle is I work, like we said at the beginning, I work at Intermountain. Intermountain has a very progressive, as many healthcare systems do now, social media department. And they are big believers in using almost every reasonable tool at our disposal for public health education. And you can be cynical and say, oh, this is some marketing tool. But no, these people really, really wanted to help me. And they may have thought I was a little bit, you know, out there, but they were on board to help me. So you're right. There was a sort of trained media professional who stood literally in the operating room all day long that day with a phone with a camera on it. And they would take pictures. Again, they were scrubbed in. They would take pictures of what was happening in the operative field. And then using the surgeon's own description, they would sort of write sentence or two about what was happening. As we've probably already made clear to your audience, the Whipple operation is an incredibly complicated procedure that in my case took 6.5 hours. The reason I'm telling you all this, Ross, kind of my rationale is, I mentioned earlier, the minority of my patients actually are candidates for the Whipple. And I've seen people who are so afraid of the surgery that even when they're eligible, which again is arguably an exception, not the rule, they don't want to go through the surgery because it just sounds so overwhelming. So in the back of my head, this was honestly my reasoning. I thought, if I can convince even one person that broken down stepwise, the Whipple is not so daunting, but actually could be done just like any procedure step by step, then this is worthwhile sharing. That was really my thinking going into it. And that's exactly what has happened is that, well, first of all, I woke up, wasted out, I was under general anesthesia the whole time. I woke up sort of in this fog. And my wife, who, by the way, was also able to follow her husband's major operation online, sort of a bizarre modern twist, said, you know, Mark, 3 million people around the world have been following your surgery on Twitter, which, again, is such a bizarre number for me to know. And first of all, there was an immediate sort of outpouring of well wishes, which was lovely as I was going through a protracted recovery. But more importantly now, Ross, it is an educational tool that I can cite to my patients. And we might get into, is it grandstanding what I did? Certainly, you can say it was exhibitionist, but again, I think I did it with reasonable purpose. It's been super, super helpful for my patients who are indeed on the fence about that operation in particular to say, hey, listen, I don't know what it's like to get chemo. I don't know what it's like to get radiation. I am not a pretender in those senses, but I can tell you exactly what happens in that operating room. And I can also tell you my experience recovering from the OR. And again, weirdly enough, it has enriched my practice. And then the other thing that we might just get into is, I talked earlier about, you know, magnetizing cancer centers. This actually has been, in the modern era, a draw. Again, I didn't go into it thinking this, but some patients seek me out specifically because they know I have this experience. And I often will tell them, my huge caveat is this does not make me a better, more competent oncologist than anyone else in my field. But I do think I have the slight ability now, slight advantage, if you will, of being able to testify exactly what going through this process is like. And so that has been enormously worthwhile, and I don't regret it one bit.
I'm relatively new to Twitter, just a few months, but fairly quickly I sort of encountered you online. But I do draw a distinction between somebody who has as many followers as you, but your tweets still seem to be not self-referential. They seem to be going for a greater good. And I draw a distinction between that and the people who you cannot help but thinking they're just self-publicists. I mean, like, here's a picture of me having breakfast this morning. It's good. That I don't care.
Right, exactly. No, I think, and this is honestly, thank you for saying that so respectfully, but it's the easiest criticism to lob at anybody, frankly, on Twitter is, oh, you're just doing it for clout or you're just doing it for followers. And, you know, that's never been my intention or goal. The hardest thing to define in someone's online activity is authenticity. You're saying, what actually is their motive in doing this? I'll tell you, especially for anyone that's listening that might be, say, an early career physician, for me, it's been a very unconventional route to, I don't even know if career advancement's the right word, but professional awareness. For instance, you and I are having this conversation right now. I'm not just paying you lip service. You are someone that I have admired for a very, very long time. But the way I first learned about you, Ross, was, again, through more sort of conventional channels where I saw your name in the author list of impactful publications, or I might have seen you speak at a major cancer conference. And I think one of the things that's been interesting, borderline iconoclastic, is, again, its best incarnation, I think Twitter sort of flattens some academic hierarchies and allows people to have a voice that they wouldn't have otherwise. But the problem is when you seize on that opportunity a bit too voraciously and you come across as only doing it to sort of advance your career, only doing it for attention, it's such a fine line to walk. I don't know if I always actually walk it correctly myself. But thank you. I think we underrate it. And perhaps the platform has a very limited lifespan now. I don't know. But I think we underrate it as a educational tool. And the last thing I'll say, not as a bug, but as a feature, Twitter is deliberately public facing. And I think it's important for all of us who are on that platform in particular to remember that what we do is visible to patients. I sometimes forget, even with as much as I post, that my patients can see everything that I'm doing. And so I like them to think of me as a full person and not just a, you know, mad scientist in a white coat. So I don't necessarily do the breakfast post that you're saying, but I do share some of myself. And with my family's permission, I share some of our life. Because again, I think we also need to tear down the notion that what we do primarily is poison people. And I'm only telling you this because I think we still have a little bit of a public relations uphill climb to overturn the notion of the oncologist as someone that makes you horribly sick. Okay. I think we have historically been conflated with the indiscriminate toxicities of some of those early chemos like we were talking about. And I think when you ask someone, you know, just off the street, what do you think an oncologist does? They may only reference chemo when, of course, now we have immunotherapy and targeted therapy, or they may only know us because some relative went through some horrible, horrible experience. And so I'm not saying I'm a saint, far from it, but I think humanizing cancer care is really, really important if our patients on some global level are going to trust us enough to seek us out in the first place.
No, I totally agree. I think one of the things that I've learned as patients went from being people you had a relatively short relationship with because of the nature of cancer,
yeah,
to longer relationships, I have seen people go through, you know, marriages, divorces, birth of children, birth of grandchildren, and you become part of their lives. And so I naturally end up sharing part of my lives too. And it's not uncommon for us to be giggling about something in the clinic together.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you said that. I often tell people, I had a trainee rotate with me recently. And at the end of their very first day rotating with me, we had a full clinic day. It was, you know, sort of one patient to the next. We didn't have a chance to breathe. At the end of the day, I said to them, what surprised you? What sort of stereotype did we overturn here today? And they thought long and hard about it. And they said, the laughter. And I thought, oh, it's not lovely. It's not quite friendship. I think we have to be careful to maintain our boundaries. And I know you and I are very careful about doing that. But I think it's important to recognize. And I think it's great. We should celebrate it. We get to develop these longitudinal relationships with people. And of course, then, it's appropriate that on some level, they would come to see us. And this is, again, I think, sort of tearing down the statues of paternalism. As people, as human beings who on some level can relate. And yeah, that sounds like a very lofty aspiration for being on social media, but it's actually one of the reasons I do it.
So I want to give you a shout out for something I saw you do just the other week. There was, somebody had posted something, and you'll probably recall this. They were a trainee somewhere, and they had posted that they felt so depressed that they were thinking about taking their own life. And amongst all of the noise of Twitter, you know, you just sort of go, well, that's just something and you just do it. But you actually stood up, running the risk of, you know, self-ridicule and said, look, hold on, does anyone know this person? Can anyone just see that they're okay? And fortunately, their boss said, no, it's all fine. But that incredibly simple act, I thought was just amazing.
Oh, you're so kind to say that. And I'm glad. Incredibly glad that that person is okay. Fleshing out too many of the details, this is a person I'll probably never meet in person around the world, literally. And I thought, gosh, things are so desperate for this person. And they feel like they have no, I guess, support from their own institution. And they're having this mental health crisis, possibly even because of their own institution, that they are issuing a cry for help on, of all places, this platform. And you're giving me, frankly, a bit too much credit. I'm bashful about that. But I thought, well, I can't just scroll by this. And one of the nice things, I suppose, about having amassed some number of followers is, you know, these social networks, they do in some sense recapitulate the relationships we have in real life. And I thought, well, I know enough people digitally that maybe someone somewhere out there actually knows how to get to this person and make sure that they're secure. So thank you for saying that. I think it's far too easy to picture Twitter as sort of this disastrously run site with very poor return on investment if you log on and try to contribute anything. But for me, you know, A, it's still a place where we can connect with one another. And B, you know, in moments like that, it makes you realize, you know, there are still people behind these avatars. There are still real people, sometimes real people who are suffering, and you can't help everybody. But in that sense, I thought, well, this is really the least I can do.
Do you feel, almost as an homage to your dad and grandfather, it's almost like a congregation?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have thought that. So I have to tell you, my dad never sent an email. Okay. So he died in 1994. I've already told you, he never got to see his work in print. I like to think he would have embraced it, probably not the same way I use it exactly. But I think we also have to realize, and now you're really going to get me high-fluting at the end of our talk, Ross, but this is kind of the second coming of the Gutenberg press. Like, I have the ability now, as do you, as does anyone on the platform, to write something, and it's immediately visible around the world. I mean, that's a relatively recent advance. I mean, and it's mind-blowing to me just how powerful it is. Now, can it destroy your career in a heartbeat if you write something truly problematic and objectionable? Absolutely. But can it also restore, maybe, or increase your faith in humanity? It can do that too. It can be both. And so I like to think it's a very mixed congregation, if that's the analogy we're going to use. And I certainly don't view myself as any sort of saint or leader on it. But I do think there's a community there, and I think we ignore it at our peril. And I think most of all, for the purposes of this conversation, we need to view it as a networking tool that can bring colleagues in healthcare together. I'd also realize that it's a discourse in which patients are, if not directly participating, they are definitely paying attention to what it is that we do. And as such, I think we owe it to ourselves and them to present not an entirely sanitized version of ourselves, but an honest version of ourselves.
Mark, I can't think of a better place to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ross, for the conversation. And I wish you and all your listeners the best of health.